Tonic Talk is a weekly dose of inspiration and encouragement from the Tonic Health family and friends on topics such as mental health and well-being. Funded by the National Lottery Communities Fund. I'm Amber Sinclair, and I'll be your weekly host, taking you on a voyage of discovery and inspiration, exploring a wide range of mental health and well-being subjects with weekly guests who will share with us their advice, their knowledge, and maybe some ideas on the day-to-day issues we're all facing in a post-pandemic world. Hello there, and thank you for joining us again on Tonic Talk Podcasts. This week, our guest is a gentleman called Nick Tovey. Now, you know me, I don't like to do too much research because I like to kind of quite naturally find out what a person is about, what they're into. But this gentleman, I did actually look up because he's written a book. He's written a book called The Revolutionary Man, The Modern Man's Guide to Life, Love and Enlightenment, whatever the that means. So I think reading from his bio, he's going to be a very interesting guest, because while he is an established, trained, experienced relationship coach, psychotherapist, he is really interested in this kind of identifying what is being a man in a modern world, because we're not looking at the same sort of makeup as of males as we always were. So have they lost their place, perhaps? Maybe you'd like to comment on something you've heard today. We've got a link in the bio that says we can listen to your audio recordings. So please use it and let us know what you think. So, good morning. Well, it's not good morning for you, it's good evening. Am I right?
It is. It
Hello is. There, good Nick. Morning. It's nice to meet you. Really nice to meet you.
You too.
So, you're in Australia.
Hence,
you are in your evening, where we are just in our morning. Well, depending on where our listeners are and the time of day. So we've not met before, Nick, but I was reading a little bit about you online because you've got a book on Amazon. So I was thinking, I'll do a little bit of research. But if you can tell our listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself so that you...
A little bit about me.
Yeah, yeah. And why it was important to talk with us.
Well, I love talking on podcasts.
Oh, brilliant. So do I, actually.
So that's good. I've got a podcast of my own, which I do with my partner, but also I'm doing a lot of interviews lately, just since I've launched my book late last year. I'm doing a lot of interviews all over the place. So I'm getting pretty good at it, I think.
Fabulous. Well, don't leave anything out, though.
I'll try. I guess a little bit more about me is I'm a counsellor, psychotherapist and coach and author, as you said. We have to add that little bit in there at the end. And my focus is mainly on the area of relationships and intimacy, but I've done a lot of work. I spent a lot of time in my career as a counsellor working with men and boys specifically, being one of those myself. And
well, it takes one through, to know one, yeah.
And also recognising how we struggle so much and in many areas of life. And I really feel that men and boys can do a lot better. And so it's been a big a bit of a passion, a bit of a mission of mine over the last 12 years or so of really helping to help men and boys reassess what that thing called manhood is and how we can let go of a lot of the ideas that, the unhealthy ideas that we've inherited and that we see in the media, and we learn these ideas, these things that make us a man, and often those things aren't very good for us. You know, they cause all sorts of problems.
Absolutely, and I think as well that, like, I was sort of looking at it and thinking, looking at the blurb for your book, and I was sort of thinking, well, that's, you know, that's a bit, like, sexist, you know. Well, women have problems with these sorts of things as well, and we've been marginalised for decades, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, you know. But I think we, in society, we have established that telling a woman that her job is to look after a man in a marriage and putting her in the kitchen and blah, blah, isn't healthy and isn't helpful, and that there is a lot more out there. Like you say, you can do better. But actually, we're kind of then coming to a point where I think there's two levels of it. One is that men didn't get the same kind of consideration. There wasn't then the, oh, well, okay, well, let's go to the men, see how we can make their lives a bit better and a bit easier. And that kind of idea of manhood and, you know, standing up to be counted, you know, you're a man or a mouse kind of terminology stuck. Whereas the female, you know, you wouldn't dare tell a woman to get back in the kitchen anymore. You know, it's just know this to be better. But also, do you think the stripping down of the women's place, I suppose, in society has led to more insecurity for men over the decades?
Well, I definitely think it has, yeah. I think there's been... Well, I mean, like you said, there's been a obviously we have, you know, when was it, 50 years ago, we had this big movement that where we did start to reimagine and reassess and really intently look at the lives of women, and rightly so, as you said, this has been a problem for thousands of years. You know, women have been oppressed for thousands of years, and of course still are in some parts of the world, and still in some ways in the West, yeah. And yet we did this amazing cultural change where we did really look at the lives of women and what we can do to make positive change there, which has been great, of course, but we forgot that there's another half of the population that also need to respond to that in a way which can work. Yeah. So whilst the focus was on making the great changes for women, men sort of got left behind and had to work out how do we do things here? What is it to be a man? How do I be with a woman who doesn't need me to, you know, bring home the bacon anymore? And, you know, she's out there earning her own crust and getting her own self empowerment and kicking ass in her own right. Like how do I be with a woman in that way? You know, and a lot of so. There's been a couple of different sort of, I guess, reactions to that. One part of the reaction to that is feeling victimized by the women's movement, by the feminist movement, and
I think that is still a problem.
Definitely. And there's good reason for that, and I think there's definitely some areas of the women's movement that have made a really good job of victimizing men, and I know where it's coming from, but it's clearly not the right way to go. And then the other reaction has been to sort of water ourselves down somewhat and become more. More feminized in a lot of ways and end up, you know, not being able to make decisions for ourselves, and, you know, the woman sort of wearing the pants in the relationship and in the household, that sort of thing, which of course has its own set of problems. It's not very sexy.
Well, and it's that's interesting to hear you say that, like a watered down version of what your father was, for example, because you've only got your role models and the men in your life that to tell you what a man's job, a man's role is. And so then if you go, right, okay, so that's not all good. I'm not meant to do that. I don't need to do that. what we never really kind of set it up in and this is what you replace it with. We just kind of said, well, we want you to be less man, but come on, be a man.
Yeah, exactly. It's really confusing.
Yeah, you can see. And it's funny because my dad, I mean, he was born 1938 and he's not with us any longer, so we don't need to worry. But he was a chauvinistic, typical, born up in Scotland. And he always said, the trouble with this women's movement is that nobody knows their place anymore. And that's I felt that was a really interesting take, because now thinking about what you're saying, is he was right in as much as he wanted it to go back to, well, he felt that it was easier before and that it should go back, but surely we sort of move on from that and we go, you know, is your book and your work about saying, well, this is the place that you can be, you know, this is where you can go to.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it is, but what I think is important is that we're in a place where, I mean, we're evolving. Yeah, human beings are evolving. We've been evolving forever, and this massive cultural shift that we are still in is a really big part of that evolutionary trajectory. So if you imagined a graph of evolution, that was a really big steep upwards incline where of evolution, where things radically shifted 50 years ago in the postmodern era. And of course, it wasn't just the women's movement. There were so many things that changed in our culture, whether it was the way we looked at war, the way we looked at civil rights, when we look the way we looked at homosexuals, the way we looked at our relationship to the planet. You know, everything changed. So our music changed, our fashion changed, color was brought into the world. You look at, you know, pre-60s fashion, it was very bleak and boring,
and they were still listening to music, particularly white middle class families in the 50s were still listening to classical music that had been written hundreds and hundreds of years before, and saying to their children, this rock and roll, this jazz, this is the devil's music.
exactly.
I didn't think of it as like, it's not just, you know, men and women and their kind of position in relationships and in life that's changed. We've had a massive overhaul the last 60, 70 years. And I suppose that takes its toll on any body that was all right in the first place, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're doing okay, men, for example, you know, we're doing okay, and then you change it all up and then you end up with a different problem then. You end up with a different conundrum. But I don't think it's always just been easy for men and the women's...
Well, I think it's... Yeah, of course. I think to think it's been easy for men. I mean, we've got this thing called the patriarchy. Yeah. So, what that essentially means is a cultural norm that emphasizes and values masculine ways of operating. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, masculine way, that doesn't necessarily mean man's ways of operating, it just means masculine as in the qualities that we use, whether that's, you know, the realms of the intellect, the realms of science and logic and reason. They're masculine qualities, whether they show up in a man or a woman. They're masculine qualities. The patriarchy has been around for about 3,000 years since pre-monotheistic religions really became the common sort of idea in societies. Prior to that, we had women were powerful in their own right. So I don't want to get too much into the historical. That blows my mind a bit.
I was just about to say, hang on a minute, you've done one of those things when I try and think about the universe and the universe is in the universe, and I just go, oh, I can't stop. My brain just explodes. But, yeah, so for thousands of years, but that was only because something was put in place as evolutionary as what has happened to us in the last 50, 60 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So so when you look at the bigger picture of the evolutionary trajectory of humanity, what we see, it's very easy to see these little shifts and changes that have occurred. And of course, the one we're talking about, the postmodern era of the women's movement and all of the other changes that happened there.
Liberties.
Yeah. Not only one of probably the biggest cultural shift in the history of humanity, but it's obviously the one that is having a greater impact on our life today.
Yeah.
And we're in it. We're here. We're the children of those of that era. You know, our parents and their parents, they didn't get to experience that. So we're the first generation, and I think this is what's really important to recognize here. As a man today, I'm the first generation of man that has been asked and invited and also demanded upon him to be in touch with his emotions and to be more sensitive and these things. You know, that is a radical shift from whatever has come before us. Yeah?
Whilst maintaining your masculine qualities.
Well, this
is
and this
that
is
where
it,
the conflict
yeah? so,
comes.
What does that even mean? You know? What does that even mean?
Yes. Yes, I do. I do have to say so that. Go on. No, sorry.
Yeah. So we've got and this is what the book talks about. Is there's this constant this bar, this measure of manhood that we're taught from day one that we have to achieve, but no one really tells you what that is. So we're constantly looking around for the examples of what that is, and we go, somebody respects him, he must be it. And of course, who are the examples that we look up to? They're our sports heroes, they're our military heroes, they're the muscle-bound gangsters on TV
Portrayed in films, books, everything, isn't it?
So we don't necessarily see it around us, those great examples around us in reality. They're always these, mythical creatures that we project this idea of manhood onto, you know. But of course, this is the measure that we're all trying to work out. And of course, we don't work it out. We fail. So if I'm not measuring up this imaginary bar of manhood, then there must be something intrinsically wrong with myself. You know, I must be something other than a man, which of course goes directly to my to shame, to feeling less than, to feeling inferior. Which can either then lead to a lack of self-esteem, which is going to then lead to either a reaction which could be bravado, trying to prove myself and be bigger than I am, or collapse into
poor mental health.
When it doesn't take long to look at, you know, the statistics of suicide and so many different social problems, to look how vastly dominated they are by men, to see that men aren't dealing with this confusion very well. Yeah.
I think it's really, really tough in today's era, because I'm always trying to instill in my son this understanding that neither is better gender. Neither has to be so specific. I said, and I've used that term, I've said, you know, people might look at me and say that I've got masculine qualities because I'm a single parent. I've had to develop, you know, skills in DIY or you know, things like that. And I said to him, and that's you know, what I hope that being part of a single parent family will teach him, is that, you know, you can be a bit of both. And in my case, I've had to be a bit of both. And he struggles with, I'm not a boy. He says, I always have to call myself a girly boy. And I said to him, what? I said, I was like, oh God, we've got a gender issue here. And it's not that we've got a gender issue. He just, he sees boys that presumably have fathers that are clear masculine role models for them. And that's what they project. And my son doesn't have that. So he doesn't feel that he lives up to that boy sort of name. And I think that's got quite a lot to do with the area that we live in as well. I know that in Lincolnshire, it's men's mental health is a particular problem because they're maybe not as confident with the whole change and evolution that we've come through, and we're kind of a little bit behind in that sense. But how do you, so what's your book? I noticed there was in a review, I read the reviews because I was intrigued, and one of the reviews talks about how you refer to spirituality. It said, while it does have a spiritual flavour, it's definitely not off with the fairies. I don't know if you've read that review, but...
I don't think I have.
he says it's a very grounded and practical book because you're discussing the issues that men typically don't discuss.
Yeah.
So how is the book, how does the book, do you feel, how would the book communicate to somebody who doesn't talk about their feelings? How does that really help? How does it do that?
Good question.
Well, I've also read in a review that it's compiled. The book is compiled section by section. Nick's pillar of potency. What is a pillar of potency, Nick? A pillar of potency. I'm not with this. You have to explain this to me.
So that's a model that I use to create some structure around how a bit of a journey that the book takes us through, and takes the reader through. And because ultimately there are so many different areas of our life that we need to address, whether that's our emotions, whether that's our sexuality, whether that's our relationship to our body, our physical health, whether that's our relationship to others, our experience of interrelationship and intimacy, and of course the our relationship to spirituality, whatever that means for us, and basically being a part of something greater than ourselves. The pillar is a progressive structure. You know, the idea, the visual of a pillar is like a totem pole. Yeah, so you imagine a Native American totem pole has various different sections that are built on top of each other. And
all right, yeah.
Yeah. So each section has a particular purpose, a particular meaning to it. Yeah. So the pillar has four sections, four tiers. So they are presence, power, passion, and purpose. So presence is all about our relationship to our body, our connection to physicality, to matter, and to our connection, our connection to the moment, however the moment is arising for us. So it's about cultivating that relationship to our moment-to-moment experience. And see, most of us, I think, in the Western world, definitely, but I think men are particularly geared this way, is that we spend so much of our life up in our mind. We're trying to analyze things, we're trying to solve problems, we're trying to think our way through life. And by doing that, we disconnect from our body. We disconnect from our felt experience. And of course, an emotion, if you think how we experience an emotion talks to us through our body. Yeah, we feel it. We feel something happening in our body. If you imagine you connect to a memory of feeling anxiety, there are going to be certain physiological cues that tell you you're feeling anxious.
We talked about that in detail when we talked about mindfulness, because it's the whole becoming aware of where you hold it. And of course, CBT is a big part of that. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a big part of trying to locate that physical feeling, that the cognitive.
Correct. Yeah. So then, you know, within psychology now, mindfulness is mixed with CBT as being a great leap forward in psychology and psychotherapeutic work, which is great.
I was going
to
say that,
to work out how what we're feeling rather than just being with our feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I am really encouraging people to do and is really to just be with the feeling, be with it without having to do anything about it, without having to try and work it out or analyze it, or definitely not to stuff it down and suppress it, which is what we've so often done.
We've learned to do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And also give the emotion some form of expression. If we're feeling angry, maybe what we want to do is grab a pillow and punch it or scream into it or give it some healthy expression in a way which isn't going to be harmful to us or to somebody else.
But run a marathon.
The emotion itself. Well, yeah, that physical exercise is definitely a great way of burning off that energy, but we're also not addressing the emotion. We're kind of distracting. Right. That's something. Yeah.
Yeah. So how does an emotion that you're just sitting with it and you're trying not to analyze it, which I think women are very, very good at, and we do this with people who, families particularly, if you are the mother of a family and you are the majority responsibility comes down to you when it comes to the kids, for example, you're always doing that. You're always analysing. And I think there's and organising and, you know, there's a lot going on. But I think we've always assumed that men or those with less maybe responsibility. I'm trying to be careful here because I don't want to say men don't think about all the other stuff, excuse me, in a relationship or in a family, because I think that would be unfair. It's not men, but a lot of men in a family maybe don't have as big a responsibility for things. So, which I have heard men say makes them better drivers, because women are bad drivers because they've got so much on their mind and they're not concentrating on the road. But what you're saying is that that's not the case at all, that there's a load of analysing going on in there. excuse me a second. Sorry.
Sort that frog out.
Oh, it's this thing in my throat. It might or might not go. But there's this idea that men are more black and white and that they don't think about stuff as much. Mm. And are we totally wrong? And I think men have projected that. I don't think women have made it up. I think men is, oh, you like sitting around talking about your feelings all the time and all you, you know, organise it. When you're driving, you drive, you think about the road, the car. Is it that easy to compartmentalise? Or are you exactly the same as the average woman? And actually stuff does go on in the brain exactly the same.
Yeah, I think for personally, I'm... I don't like to box anybody into a stereotype. I think that we're much more complex than that, and that we have much more breadth and depth than any stereotype and box can provide us. And you know, they limit. A box is going to create limitations and boundaries around who I can be. And this is exactly what I'm talking about, why this, you know, this idea of what a man should be or a woman should be is, let's just discard those ideas and allow people to just be who they are. Of course, there are certain characteristics that we learn through the ways in which we've been conditioned. Yeah. So what I was talking about before, if we were talking about masculine qualities, the way I like to look at the qualities of masculine and feminine is a spectrum. Yeah. If you imagine we've got a line with masculine on one end and feminine on the other, and there's a whole spectrum of these qualities and gifts that exist on that spectrum. But what we've done, and what a big part of the problem is that we've genderized masculine and feminine. So we've said that masculine is only for the men and feminine is only for the women. But what we know is that that's not true. You know, we all have access to the entire spectrum of these qualities of masculine to of feminine.
As much as in European languages, the masculine and the feminine is given to nouns, to objects. Why is a table a female? Well, we're not saying it's a woman. Yeah. We're just saying it, you know. That's came to mind when you said that. Exactly. But I like the idea of a spectrum.
Yeah, totally.
And that men have definitely been cornered into that end and told, well, that's where you need to be. And if you're anywhere else on the spectrum, you need to... Mm-hmm. You know, give yourself a kick up the butt and grow a pair and go and get in the other, go and get in your box sort of thing.
Exactly. Or you must be gay. And then you get ostracized into another inferior box of not quite manly enough. And that's, you know, that's of course been the shame so many have had to live with, that may not actually express their expression up the masculine end of the spectrum. Yeah. So what we've done with through the women's movement is encourage women to adopt and
explore,
adapt to explore and expand themselves across that spectrum. But we haven't necessarily done the same for the men in the other direction. Yeah. So,
And that's really apparent even today. I was going to say, sorry to interrupt you, but even today, I mean, look how the little that I've entertained to gaze across on social media and all of the media coverage of Harry, our royal. Prince Harry, and how he has been supposedly, you know, demasculinized by this woman. And this is 2021. And yet we're still pushing this, he needs to grow a pair and tell her, blah, 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 and come back to England. And really, God, how antiquated.
Yeah.
But I suppose that all comes from an antiquated system. So. It was more likely to happen there, but yeah.
Yeah, so if you very simply look at the qualities of masculine and feminine, you know, masculine is directional. Yeah, there's a linearity to masculine quality. So it's focused, where feminine is more flow. So if masculine is go, feminine is flow, and it takes in more of a broader spectrum. Yeah. So what you were talking about before around a woman is more naturally taking in more of the world and thinking about more things and trying to do more things. And a man is more focused on one particular you use the example of driving a car. He's just driving a car. He's just got the road and nothing else is going on.
And let
on.
Me just clarify to our listeners, I didn't come up with this stuff, right? I'm really, really not anti-men, although I do come across a bit anti-men sometimes, but that's...
Well, I don't know if it's...
A whole other podcast.
Come across to me as an anti-man comment. It's just the way that we're recognizing the difference. Yeah,
absolutely. And the way that men have told me we are different as well. And women have told us we were different. I mean, there was that book that came out, I suppose, when I was young, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Mm-hmm. And actually what you're talking about is that there is the masculine qualities and there are the feminine qualities and they're on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So... Mm-hmm. You know, emotionally and in terms of our, not our physical, but our mental capabilities and qualities, there's nothing really that you tend to, if you're born male, go towards the masculine qualities because your environment encourages you to go towards the masculine qualities. That's not necessarily where you would sit naturally if you were in a genderless world, you know.
Exactly. And it's not a necessary, I mean, I don't personally think that a genderless world, and I'm not trying to create or encourage androgyny. I think it's important that we have difference and that we have our freedom to be able to express the difference in genders. But what I'm not okay with is anybody being boxed and shoved up into a particular way of being because that's how they should be. What I'm really interested in is freedom of expression, of how we are as human beings, being free to express who we are without being conditioned and boxed into being a certain way. And what I think happens, and I think, of course, has a contribution to our negative mental health and our low self-esteem and a lot of problems that we see in the world, is our belief in who we are, because we believe there's something wrong with us. So if we're in a world that is not welcoming me in my natural expression of my own unique humanity, then I'm going to feel that there's something wrong with me. I'm going to feel that I'm not good enough, or I should be, you know, changing myself to fit a certain way.
Acceptance, we've learned through these. I mean, I've learned so much about that through podcasts. Acceptance is half the battle with any sort of mental health issue or like self-esteem, anxiety. Yep. It's exactly that. It's like you say, it's accepting that you can be who you want to be without having to fit a mold, because the mold has been so clear and so strictly defined for so long that we're finding it hard to take the mold away. But then people would argue then, well, if you don't have a mold, especially if you were jelly, for example, about that, but you don't get anywhere. You don't form anything. You don't know where you're going, what your places are. Are these molds, are our molds our role models? Or are they our parenting? Are they our education? Are they how we're born, do you think? Or is it just a massive mix of all of it?
I mean, it's an interesting analogy you've brought there of the mold. I don't want to fit within a mold. I want to be able to be creating. You know, a mold is a structure, yeah? If you imagine a mold being a structure, but it's a structure that exists around the outside. Mm-hmm. And if I've got a structure that is existing around the outside, that means I'm limited in how I can grow and express. Yeah.
And jelly doesn't grow, so it's not a great analogy.
Jelly doesn't grow, so it's
that,
not a
so
great
we can't we scrap that analogy, everyone. You
jelly
are not,
needs a mold.
Not
jelly.
Jelly
needs a mold.
Jelly needs a mold totally... because it cannot grow.
Exactly.
It's an inanimate object. But okay, this is a good point then, because a plant grows. So you put it in a pot, you have to put it in a pot for it to grow. We have to
and
put it in the ground
when,
for it to grow.
What happens if it's in too small a pot?
It gets stunted. And it dies. Yes.
And it dies.
See, and we've made something as the analogy now. We can make that work.
We went to a good analogy after the jelly one. That
As you were. Yeah, you were. It's interesting to think that we are a product of a lot of things, but that these days we hope that, and I've definitely noticed it in primary education, that we are more about the whole spectrum, and that anyone in a classroom could fit within any one of those qualities, are our children, this generation of primary school children, going to be able to express their emotions more clearly? Is your book aimed at people that were educated, you know, this generation where there was definitely a very clear mold, or is this going to continue? Or is this going to be a problem always?
I think it's always going to, because we're always changing, we're always evolving. Yeah, so these are the current issues that we're grappling with in this particular stage and phase of our own human evolution. Yeah, so the generations to come, they're going to be facing different issues. But what is definitely clear is, you know, I'm a parent so my youngest is 17, my eldest is 25. So I've seen them grow up in a very different world than the one I grew up in. And, you know, their freedom around gender expression and sexuality is vastly different to the one that I grew up in, and that is beautiful. And I mean, when we talk about the changes that have occurred in the recent history around gay marriage and the whole freedom of expression in the LGBTQIA... alphabet, which is available, you know. So just the fact that we have opened up our perspective to include so many different expressions of gender and sexual orientation is a massive leap in change, yeah. And of course that also provides a whole other bag of confusion, as you know, we're trying to I want to express myself naturally, so I need to bracket myself into some form of expression, you know, and give myself a label so I can then belong to the right group. So that's an interesting
your
point,
plant your plant needed needs a pot. You see, I'm going back, I'm working with the analogy. Your plant needs a pot. You don't want to be a seed flying off in the wind. You do want to be a pot, in a pot, but then you've still got to be able to grow and move out of that pot if you need to.
Let's go with this.
Come on,
this
Nick, commit to
so,
it.
The pot is our self-identity.
Okay.
The pot is our self-identity. It's our expression, our belief in who we are. Yeah. So as we're growing and developing through, you know, from being a seedling up to taking up the entire pot, we are nurtured by our environment, by the people around us, by the culture we grow up in, by the education system that we grow up in, by the religion that we're influenced by all of the experiences, good and bad, that we've had in our life. All of those are going to create that plant that exists within that pot. And so the pot is the boundary, or is the self-identity that we call I. This is the person that I am. And so this is what we call the ego in psychology. Yeah. So this is the self-identity. And so it has a purpose. It has a benefit until we get to that point where we need to outgrow the pot. Where we want to expand beyond the pot. And so then we need to be planted in the earth.
Where the possibilities are endless.
Where the possibilities are endless, where we're limitless. We can grow, we can intertwine with other roots. We can grow as big as we can possibly be. And the structure holding us is ourself. It's holding us from the inside. Yeah, we're not held up and held in by this perspective, this idea of who we are, and a perspective, an idea that we've inherited, that we've been given, and then of course enrolled in.
I'd just like to say, Nick, that was not where I thought my little narrative about the plant was going to go, but you really. It is difficult, though, isn't it? That do you find that? See, the thing with tonic talk is, I always have a little bit of an edge when I'm a little bit edgy when I speak to people that are qualified and trained in psychology. Apart from the fact that I think there's a possibility you're analysing me and what I say, but that's just my own paranoia. That just shows where my ego lies. But also that the terminology isn't always relevant, and without meaning to, that analogy, it's probably gone right over most people's heads. But to me, an analogy is a way of understanding the psychology of it for the normal everyday person who's just maybe goes out and starts to think of themselves as a plant in a pot. And think about the pot that maybe, or the environment around the pot that isn't working for them, and then make that change or whatever. But
that's all right.
It's quite astounding me what you've done with the analogy there. I understand a bit more about psychology than I did before.
It's a really great metaphor. I'm surprised myself how well it worked.
When you say you've done lots and lots of interviews, you haven't done any with me yet. I do tend to go off on one. Oh, God, I apologise. No, I mean, I don't apologise because that was fantastic.
No.
I love what you did with it there. But do you think men do have...
Can I just add a little bit to it? Just to tie the analogy off a little bit. So that, you know, I think often we come to a place in our life when that structure that is containing us, either we get it gets little cracks in it and we start to see through to the outside and recognize that there's actually more for us available, and that is when we go and seek and we go and think, we realize that, you know, my perspective has been opened a little bit, my eyes have been opened, I can see a little more that's out there, and I want to go and search, I want to go and seek.
Which also comes with age as well, doesn't it?
Which it does, and it's not always dependent on age either. And sometimes that crack can be a cataclysmic shattering that occurs, and those, you know, somebody dropped the plant pot and the pot shattered. And that is a crisis in our life, where the self-identity, the structure that we've created around ourselves to create a sense of who we are, but also a sense of safety and security in that image of who we are, collapses and shatters, and that can be a really big crisis moment in a person's life, and a really, really big growth moment that we can go through. Yeah. So it's an interesting perspective to look at it, to look at from that way, you know, and that is exactly what happened to me, which got me into the work that I do, is I had one of those cataclysmic moments in my early 20s and went through my own really challenging experience, which I speak a lot of in the book. And
you do, there's something about you were attacked, weren't you? Left beaten. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was almost 23 at the time, and this happened in Rotherham, up in near Sheffield. And I was out clubbing with my brother and a friend of ours, and ended up having, you know, too many drinks, being rowdy lads, and ended up getting beaten up by five bouncers in a club, and forcibly removed whilst being punched and kicked, and basically just for spitting beer at my brother. But obviously it wasn't great behaviour, but we definitely didn't deserve that. And anyway, I ended up in hospital, thought I was going to die for a while, and then ended up having surgery and having a spleen removed, and after a few broken ribs, and going through a really big journey with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and severe depression.
Yes, yeah.
So that was the collapse of my identity, where this man that I thought I was, and by this time I'd been in the Navy for 5 years. I'd been around the world, and I was just got engaged to the woman that became my wife, and then my ex-wife, and we were having she was pregnant with our child, and so I'd done quite a bit of living and created quite a bit of a idea of who I was as a man. You know, I was quite confident in myself and done quite a bit of amazing things in my life by that time.
And if you were considered yourself a manly man.
Exactly. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I wasn't. And I was having these experiences that I'd never had before. These really strong, powerful, crippling anxiety experiences where I was unable to cope with life, with being outside, with being in social situations, with any hint, any sniff of conflict would send me into a panic. So, you know, this experience was firstly going through this experience, I realized how woefully ill-equipped I was to deal with my life when it wasn't working. And how ill-equipped I was to deal with emotion. And not only that, what I also realized as I went and tried to seek support and help, the world really didn't welcome me with open arms as a man that was dealing with some difficult stuff, a broken man. And so this was a really challenging situation for me, and which of course then created put a bit of a rocket up my bum to, you know, go forwards and learn about my own experience, create a meaning from my own experience, learn about psychology and spirituality and philosophy, and go and become a counselor and therapist,
and commit your life to making sure that other men don't feel the way that you were made to feel, or the way that you did feel.
At least trauma. Help resource men to deal with life's shit as it happens, because it will, and it does. And one of the ways in which we deal with emotion when we deal with challenging situations is to pretend it's not there, and stuff it down and not face it and avoid it like
a plague. And that's not exclusive to men.
No, of course not. Of course not.
There are a lot of do you know what's interesting as well? I was just about to say, and I was referencing someone close to me rather than, again, putting people in boxes, but it seems to me that high-powered positions has a lot to do with not dealing with emotions, because a lot of the business side of things, the emotion isn't part of, you can't put an emotion into a business plan. A CEO won't be seen to be getting emotional about a project. It's just, that's just not how business works, or worked, I should say. But we spoke to Barbara Mayhew recently, who's a local counsellor and provides services for companies, because she was saying that that is very much the case. It's kind of CEO, so it wouldn't necessarily be men. It might be women in the positions of power. And like I say, relevant to someone close to me, has recently been told, yeah, you know, that's what you're doing. You're just not dealing with the emotion. But that's how she gets on. That's how she manages her life. That's how she manages to keep all the plates spinning, because she doesn't deal with it. But ultimately, grief.
Those plates will come crashing down at some point.
Well, yeah. Grief was the thing, I think, that kind of just stopped the ability to keep spinning, and therefore there was all this stuff left. So, yeah, again, I wouldn't want people thinking that are listening to this that we are talking about only men that think like this. Your expertise is with men as a gender, because of the way they've been brought up and the way that they've, well, put themselves in a box. They've put themselves in a pot, haven't they? You said that yourselves.
Well, yeah, I think we've all done it to ourselves. We're all enrolled in the same system, you know, the same culture, and like I've said, it's we are changing, we are evolving, and it's time to, and incidentally, you know, I call the book The Revolutionary Man, and I put the R in brackets, because this is a play with the words and the distinction between evolution and revolution. So evolution is passive change that happens gradually over time, where revolution is radical change that is fueled by inspired action. So revolution is when we are consciously engaged in our own evolution. Yeah, we are fired up. There's a level of tension that we've reached where we need to make change, because we cannot stand living in the status quo anymore. And then we are inspired to make that change. So what I think the book is really encouraging us all to do, and what my work is really encouraging us all to do, is to take ownership for our own evolution, to take responsibility for it, and recognize that, yes, I live within the system. Yes, I've got these ways in which I've been conditioned and steered to be a certain way, but I'm in charge of my life. I get to call the shots, and I get to design the life that I live from here on in with every decision I make and every word that I speak and every act that I enact. About empowering each of us with that self-responsibility.
By empowering yourself with that responsibility, you're covering kind of all the bases. I love that idea that, you know, that's evolution, and it's going to happen, and it is happening, and it has happened, and it's like any sort of progress, you can't stop it. You've got to reinvent a way, you know, you've got to work with it, you've got to revolutionize, you've got to think about it differently, think outside the box, blue sky thinking, whatever phrases are about. But it seems to me that that's what you did when you suffered with the PTSD after your pot was well and truly smashed, that you found your way out of it but not to go and put yourself, not to go and remake a pot and put yourself back in it, because then that could have happened again. Does that make sense? But you,
definitely,
you're inspiring people to go and get, you know, get something out of it. Get the good. Mm-hmm. It's opened a door rather than ruined your life.
Yeah.
How easy is that? I mean, how many people do you see in crisis that can think like that? Is it that easy?
It's not easy at all. It's really not easy. But I guess there's, and of course, there's no forcing anybody to see things that way. Mm. Yeah. But don't get me wrong. You know, I spent, you know, years being a victim to my circumstances, feeling like I'd been hard done by, and I didn't deserve what happened, and you know, I'm just going to sit and wallow in my quagmire and feel like I am entitled to in some ways because I was victimized, because I was the victim. You know, we do, and this isn't just, you know, I was a victim. You know, I was a victim of a violent act, and there's a way in which we can cling to that identity of victim,
right? Yeah,
keeps us in that little box, you know, and
you just put yourself in a different plant pot and
don't look
beyond it.
Yeah. So what I'm really, you know, what I wanted for myself was not to be a victim to it.
What was that moment? You know? What, explain to me that moment.
Yeah,
because there'll be so many people listening who are going, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yeah.
I want to do this.
Yeah.
What does it feel like?
So for me, what I felt was gross dissatisfaction at the support that was available to me. And there was, I remember, you know, walking in, going to the first GP when I was in the midst of crisis point, where I'd lost it. You know, I wasn't dealing very well with life. It was probably a small psychotic break, but definitely not insignificant. And I went and told him what I was experiencing, and I saw extreme discomfort and fear on the eye, on the face of this middle-aged male doctor. And I was like, wow, you're supposed to be here to to help me. And that was the first experience. And then I had a few different experiences similar to that, you know, where just to recognize people's discomfort. But what was obvious to me was that these people that were in supposedly powerful positions, like the doctors and the medical profession, that were supposed to be there to support me and help me, they really just wanted to give me, they really just wanted to give me a box of pills and send me on my way. And I knew that that wasn't the answer. I knew that there was more to it than that. There was, I guess it was just this intuitive knowing that there was more to this situation and more to that I could experience. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that medication isn't sometimes necessary. It is.
But yeah, we've reiterated that on our program before. Sometimes it's the only way to be able to access help and to move on.
Correct. Yeah.
It doesn't solve anything.
No,
completely.
It's something. Well, for me, I can only speak for myself. But it was like I said, we're talking antidepressants. They gave me a baseline from where I could then move.
Yes. Yeah.
I could then act. I could then go and seek something else. But they weren't they definitely weren't helping me heal. They weren't helping me find resolution to the situation that I was in. So yeah, there was, so I think the first thing that really hit home for me was finding meditation as a practice, and this was back in the days when we had cassettes, and I had a Walkman I got this cassette, and it was just a simple body scan meditation that I would listen to, and I got it to help me sleep because I was, the anxiety was giving me sleeping problems. So I got it for that purpose, and I was like, wow, there's something here. This is giving me benefits.
Better.
Yeah. Giving me benefits that I didn't expect I was going to have. And so I dove into meditation a little more as a tool, as a practice, but also then became a bit more of a lifestyle situation. You know, I swear by it now and still have a healthy meditation practice 20 odd years later. This is one of the amazing privileges that I think we have at this time, is that, you know, thanks to all the hippies in the 60s and that brought a lot of the Eastern traditions over to the West, they've become much more commonplace. And, you know, these are ancient traditions and practices that have been done for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, you mentioned mindfulness. You know, Jon Kabat-Zinn was responsible for bringing mindfulness into the Western medical field. How fortunate are we that there are, you know, the fact that, you know, we're living in this time where not only is it okay for us, do we have permission to go and seek help? It's there. It's available. And we have amazing people like you doing podcasts, and which we can just listen to and get information for free. It's so good. So good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so, so much for your time today, Nick. And hopefully I'll be able to drop you an email with some questions from our listeners, perhaps, or that some of them buy the book and have a look for themselves. So, great. Well, it was lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Wow, what a fascinating take on the modern man. I would love to speak to some people in our community who identify with what Nick's been saying this evening, because he really is pinning a point there that a lot of men, I mean, our suicide rates for men is just astonishing in this country, and it shouldn't be happening. I implore anyone that's listening to this to talk to the man in your life, and if you are the man, then to talk to somebody if there's anything that you are struggling with. I found a poem online that I found rather amusing, but this particular writer pins something here that speaks to me about the 21st century modern man, that men maybe believe that it's about winning, maybe from their fathers, maybe from their brothers. It's about winning, it's about achieving. And Silverstein in this poem seems to suggest that, well, what if we recognise everyone's participation? What if there are no winners? What's wrong with just having fun? Why does everything have to be a fight? So this is Hug of War by Shel Silverstein. I will not play at tug of war. I'd rather play at hug of war, where everyone hugs instead of tugs, where everyone giggles and rolls on the rug, where everyone kisses and everyone grins and everyone cuddles, and everyone wins.